It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get four 5G phones on us and four lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Unlike many other jurisdictions across the country during the pendency of COVID and the pandemic, where you saw rising crime rates throughout the country. In Jefferson Parish, the crime rates were some of the lowest that you've seen since 1974. And it seems as though they are have been able to keep that momentum going, because it seems that in the first 6 months of this year, 2024, that they continue to experience a reduction in crime. And we are joined by Sheriff Joe Lapinto from the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. Joe, welcome to I'm sorry. I thought we had Joe. We don't have Joe just yet. They just reported their first 6 months of crime stats this year. And it is revealing a 6% drop in crime this year for the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. And last year they experienced an 11% drop the previous year. And I thought we had him. We do not have him. Well, let's go to a break and we'll try and get hooked up with Sheriff Joe Lapinto, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free, all on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Welcome back, folks. We have Sheriff Joe Lapinto from the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. Joe, right before you came on, I was talking about how y'all posted crime stats for the first 6 months of this year, experiencing a 6% reduction over, and last year for the first 6 months, an 11% drop in the previous year. This is great news, and you guys have reported a drop in every category of the seven major categories that are reported to the FBI, otherwise known as UCR.
Yeah, so far so good. I mean, look, the theft has always crept up a little bit year after year after year, but we've seen steady decreases in major crimes like murder and robbery, especially over the last few years. And so to see it in all seven categories is a great thing. And look, our the statistics going through even July continue to go in the right direction. I mean, our murder rate is very, very low this year. You know, unreasonably low, to be honest with you, which is was a great thing. We didn't have a murder for over 2 months during the summer, which was, you know, really unusual. But we're doing a good job of solving them and then continue to, you know, put bad guys in jail and keep them from reoffending. So,
Joe, let's talk about that for a moment. You had, I think, nine total of 16 homicides as of Thursday of last week, and with arrest in all but three of the cases. That's an 81% solution rate. That's an extraordinarily high solution rate in and of itself, but even more so within the same year of the happenstance of the murder.
It is. I mean, and look, let's face it, the year's not over with. We know we have suspects in some of the other ones, too, that, you know, aren't shown as solved because we don't have a person in custody. But the fact of it is if we continue through the end of the year, that number will be even higher. And, look, our men and women always do a great job of making me look good. You know, they know how to get the technology that exists today to get the evidence that they need. Sometimes you don't always have it. I mean, we talk about law enforcement. You know, we don't do a great job of preventing crime because we don't know when the next homicide's going to happen. And look, let's face it, neither is the victim that's going to, you know, be the victim of that homicide. Our job is to show up afterwards and collect the evidence, and we do a good job of collecting that evidence. Most of the time, it's going to give us enough of what we need to develop probable cause and make an arrest. Sometimes the evidence just doesn't exist, and it's not necessarily the detective's fault. You may have an idea of who you thought was involved, but when you don't have the witness and don't have the evidence that goes along with it, it's a lot harder to develop that case.
Well, you do prevent crime to the extent that when you selectively incapacitate the impact criminal of violent crime, you know statistically they're going to reoffend, right? And if they're behind bars, they can't reoffend.
Yep. As I always say, we don't prevent crime, right? What we do is we solve crime quickly to prevent the next crime from happening. You know, right. I don't want an individual to get 10 armed robberies from us. I want to catch him after the first and prevent 2, 3, 4 through 10 from ever occurring, right? And so I didn't prevent number one, but what I prevented was the fourth and fifth one down the road from occurring. And that's how you deal with prevention, right? It's always going out there and making those solved cases and making them quickly. And look, you had a big part of that. You know, I always give credit to our crime lab. You know, the ability for us to be able to run fingerprints, run firearms, run DNA within a very short period of time and not wait for a regional lab or a state lab to give us back evidence. I want that information back in a week or a day compared to a month or 6 months. And if you're able to get that information back within that week, think about all the crimes you prevented from happening waiting for the same information to come back 6 months later.
You guys have set out to deploy newer technologies as well. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, right now, in those article, we have about 30 or so drones that we use on an everyday basis in the parish, but they are individually operated drones, whether it's part of our SWAT team flying a drone inside of a house at a location, or just us utilizing it for a search and rescue, whatever the case may be, we have drones. But there's even newer technology that requires different FAA approval, but it's a drone as a first responder. So imagine having 10 stationary drones on a rechargeable platform on rooftops all around the parish, with one person in a room that has the ability to launch and fly those drones to a location, hooked up to the CAD system, the computer-aided dispatch system of 911. So you call 911 from a location and say, I think I see someone in my backyard. That automatically launches to the drone room. They have the GPS coordinate. They press a button. The drone hatch opens up. It flies to that location. And now it is streaming live data of the backyard before the deputy even arrives. So it doesn't make a difference if I only have one deputy available. I have a drone that has 360-degree coverage of whether a person jumps over the back fence or side fence or whatever the case may be. It can be there in seconds, depending on the location of a house, to where the drone is. And that technology exists today. It's cutting edge. It's not necessarily in anybody's backyard now. You've got to work with the FAA to get waivers. Obviously, we're a Class B airspace with the airport, but it is something that's doable. And for us, it's about leveraging technology. You know, we always are going to have problems of filling the spots of a police officer today. You know, we're in better shape than most, but let's be realistic. You know, it's a lot harder to get 100 people in academy like we did back in the 90s. And so I've got to be able to leverage technology for the future, knowing that the amount of people that want to be policemen is lesser. So we're looking to do that. But what does the future of law enforcement look like? And, you know, I think this is one of those things that we certainly have to consider. We haven't done it yet, but we're certainly considering it.
But y'all have deployed the older style drones with a lot of success rate, utilizing that in helping your task forces. I know that y'all have done it in fighting a number of different categories of crime. You may not want to reveal that, but it's been successful. I mean, I remember you telling me a couple of stories about a year ago, and you know, I was kind of blown away by the coordination of the technology with the human capital on the street.
It's unreal. I mean, I can remember being a young narcotics detective back in the 90s and, you know, beginning of 2000, sitting in the back of a, you know, white van with a ladder on the top of it and a periscope out the back. And we had an ice chest in there, but basically its own swamp cooler, and sitting in a van, you know, sweating to the nines and sitting here looking out of a periscope at somebody down the street for a narcotics investigation. Now we have a drone that's literally a mile away from the suspect's house. Can't be heard, can't be seen because, you're not even close to it. But the camera on this drone is zoomed in at the front door, and we're able to watch an individual that's dealing drugs out of their house and develop the information that we need without even having a person on the block. It goes to show you how technology has changed the game by any means. I mean, you know, I laugh about it. You know, me and the other men and women that I served with back in the day, I'm like, I wish I had these tools 20 years ago, because they were certainly it's a fun way to do investigations.
No, absolutely. One of the observations I made before you came on in the intro is that the JPSO was able to continue to drive crime down during the pandemic, where most jurisdictions across the country were experiencing, you know, kind of a crime explosion in many cases. Y'all had a couple of categories where crime, I think, may have gone up, but not by any double-digit number that you saw in other jurisdictions. Have you done after action on that, or was there anything that changed, or was it just, again,
you
just
know, I truly believe
the dot?
That. Well, I truly believe your response time means everything to a community. And I don't care what community you live in, the citizens of that community want a safe place to live in, right? And so you may have individual pockets of individuals that are bad, but for the vast majority, that population is good. And so you've got to be able to get to people. When someone's calling for help and calling 911, even if it's a mundane crime, they're having a bad day. They're having a bad day. Nobody calls 911 with good news. And so for them to call 911, you've got to be able to get to them. And again, it goes back to how do you prevent that crime from happening? We kept working during the pandemic. You know, we may have changed a little bit, but at the end of it, we still kept working. We still, you know, went out there and answered the calls for service and figured out what the crime was and, you know, started looking at cameras and who can we identify as the criminal? And we didn't stop that. And so whether it's a pandemic or a hurricane or any other event that happens, JPSO is ready and willing to respond.
Now, you guys, for the last, I don't know how many years, you may know, have posted the lowest crime rate years in Jefferson Parish since 1974, when we started collecting and reporting data to the FBI. And I told you this a while back. My goal was always to get down below 10,000 UCR Part 1 crime offenses reported. I was never able to do it. Got relatively close. You actually did it, I think, year before last. Y'all were at 9,300 or something reported crimes that year.
And then last year or the year before, we bumped up a little bit, which was one little small increase, less than 5%. But it looks like if we keep going the same route, we're going to have another decrease of year. It's a great feeling to be able to have. I look at different things that are there, but crime stats are completely different all over. I think perception of crime has continued to be through the roof, but for the same reasons the public sees the crime that's happening, we also see the same crime and have the better ability to solve it. When you go back to our peak, which was in 1991, we had 31,000 UCR reports that year. So to be under 10,000 today is a great achievement, not only for the sheriff's office, but for the community that we live in.
No, there's no doubt. Continuing to make that difference day in and day out. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate it. Congratulations to you and the men and women of the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office in the successes that they've had. And I know you guys always talk about appreciating the community at large and their belief in what the JPSO does, because that makes all the difference in the world, right?
It does. Thanks a lot, Sheriff. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
All righty, folks. That's Sheriff Joe Lapinto from the Sheriff of the Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office. We will be right back after the break, 504-260-1870. We'll visit with Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council Member, District A, when we return. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council Member, District A. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Noel.
Joe, you guys had a meeting the other day with the Sewage and Water Board, Gassan Corbin, and some of the members of his staff talking about billing issues. If you would, give us a summation of that meeting.
Well, look, before we went to the meeting, we said to Sewage and Water Board, this meeting will go very smoothly for you if you agree that the billing is an issue and has not been done correctly, and you agree that the council has your best interest at heart and to work with our contractor who has been doing work with you already. And instead of doing that, they read a prepared statement that, in our view, suggested that they were not fully embracing what the council wants to do. And we really pretty much got extraordinarily frustrated, if not really downright angry, because it's killing us. And in fact, right before I was coming on the air, the last email I had is from a resident who says, my bill is...
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council Member, District A. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Noel.
Joe, you guys had a meeting the other day with the Sewage and Water Board, Gassan Corbin, and some of the members of his staff talking about billing issues. If you would, give us a summation of that meeting.
Well, look, before we went to the meeting, we said to Sewage and Water Board, this meeting will go very smoothly for you if you agree that the billing is an issue and has not been done correctly, and you agree that the council has your best interest at heart and to work with our contractor who has been doing work with you already. And instead of doing that, they read a prepared statement that, in our view, suggested that they were not fully embracing what the council wants to do. And we really pretty much got extraordinarily frustrated, if not really downright angry, because it's killing us. And in fact, right before I was coming on the air, the last email I had is from a resident who says, my bill is wrong. It's overbilled by $600 and it's killing us. And I think, Newell, for us, it's two things. Number one, the volume of complaints that we get from residents and even from people who live outside the parish and went is overwhelming. And two, it just does not feel like Sewage and Water Board has had the requisite amount of urgency to deal with this for the last now 8 years. And it kills their credibility. You can't go somewhere and say, well, they've done a good job on this infrastructure project or with raising money to do the substation, if the person says, yeah, that's all nice and well, Joe, but I have a $500 bill right now and I should be paying $150. So the upshot of the meeting is, I think we expressed the deep concern, anxiety, frustration of our residents. We're going to pass a couple of instruments, I think, at this upcoming council meeting. And our expectation, Newell, is that the contractor that we have working for us now on the back end side of billing, who's doing everything once you get through the full adjudicatory process and trying to move them up so they become the front end, is going to be implemented as quickly as possible.
Yeah, you know, I interviewed Ghassan the other day about the council's request for the door hanger being placed on the door when they would go out and check the system as a way to notify the homeowner that they were there and that they actually checked on it, or that their meter was read. And he was telling me what they were trying to do instead of that, that they thought was more meaningful. I said, well, you know, Ghassan, it all depends on one's perspective. I mean, the council's getting their brains beat in, and this is not even in their main lane of travel, right? But they're getting all the calls and everything else. So they're looking for a means to be able to provide information and have the homeowners with the information, and information is power, that the meter was read. And it provides a level of comfort for folks, because there's a belief that runs, I think, throughout the city, you would know better than I, that they're not reading the meters, right?
That's exactly right. And look, Newell, to that, a couple of things. First, Sewage and Water Board's own policy, not the council policy, not the Morrell policy, not the Caruso policy, Sewage and Water Board's policy, is that meters are to be estimated 1 month and then actually read the next. And obviously, preferably, actually as much as possible. But if it can't be done, it is to flip-flop between an estimate and an actual. I have too many times when the bill is not being read actually by somebody, and for 3, 4, or more months, they receive an estimate. So that's not us dictating to Sewage and Water Board. That's not following your own policy. And then two, obviously an actual read is going to be much better than anything else. Number two, Councilmember Morrell is really the one who's pushed this door hanger concept and or a picture. One of the things we wanted to do was, fine, if you don't want to do a door hanger, then take a picture of the meter at the time of the actual reading and then have it be available to the customer. Well, Sewage and Water Board told us in the meeting 2 weeks ago that they had to integrate the software between three different companies in order to be able to do that. So I said, well, great. I know Councilmember Morrell's been talking to you for months about this. Here we are today meeting. You knew this meeting was coming up. Tell me when your meetings are with all three vendors to do this. Well, they had a meeting set with one, but not with the other two. So it's just, in my mind, I realize this is a big problem and they know it's a problem, but it's how do you do the things that you need to do to show the customer that you are trying to get them the accurate information? Obviously, somebody for now, until the smart meters are installed, actually physically reading the meter and then having proof that the actual meter is read is incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand, and I said this to him, I don't understand the hesitancy, because everybody's trying to reestablish credibility. And I think we can agree on one thing, that the Sewage and Water Board doesn't have a lot of credibility right now. And without credibility, you're never going to move the mood of the public behind an organization. It's hard for anyone to really enjoy and celebrate the successes that they may have by moving to the smart meter program or the development of this, that, or otherwise. And the way you are reestablish credibility, in my humble opinion and in my experience, is that small steps at a time. There's no one panacea solution, no silver bullet, whatever cliche you want to apply to it. Doesn't work that way. They want to see an outcome. They want to see action. They don't want to just hear words, and they want to see more than one action that leads to a successful outcome, right?
I 100% agree with you. And look, during that meeting, I even brought up by myself, not by anybody's prompting, the smart meters. I've actually been places, both through email, through people telling me, in neighborhood meetings, where people have said, I have the smart meter, and oh my gosh, we had a leak, and the smart meter notified us very quickly, and we were able to remedy it in real time. Well, that gets exactly to the point you're making, which is, here is a change. People see the change, and they believe in it. And I think what you're really kind of getting at is something my parents used to tell me all the time growing up, which is actions speak louder than words.
Mm-hmm.
People want to see what's going on. And look, I think generally, and particularly New Orleans, people know the infrastructure is old. They know it's been neglected for decades. They know that there are problems. But when you say to them, all right, this is the way we're going to remedy it. This is our timeline. This is what's going to go on. And then you either meet the timeline and people go, oh, this is fantastic. This is exactly what we're looking for. And incremental for most people is exactly the type of change they're looking for. But then if you don't meet it, when you don't follow the council's rules, when you don't follow your own regulations, then people lose faith. And again, that anxiety turns into frustration and unfortunately even anger.
So what is the outcome going to be in your mind? I mean, are we going to get through this, or is it going to continue to be contentious? I mean, it's a little mind numbing, I think, for folks that we're not all pulling the wagon in the same direction.
Look, that's my greatest frustration. And look, Noel, here's two things I think listeners should be thinking about as I say this. Number one, the council is providing money to Sewage and Water Board to help with the customer service piece about making sure that if you get a bad bill or an accurate bill, it gets rectified as quickly as possible. So we're not berating the agency and saying, well, we're not going to help you. That's number one. Number two here also is we're the ones taking, in my view, sort of the political risk, because if what we're trying to do doesn't work, then it's on the council, who has tried to do something different and trying to go a different path, and not Sewage and Water Board, who just is going to have another problem. So my hope is we get on the same page and we do a couple of things pretty simply. Number one is we're going to put out an RFP, request for proposal, for somebody to come in and help Sewage and Water Board with the initial billing process. And obviously, the first step is to try and prevent that bad bill from going out, period. But then where we're really dedicating the most amount of funds is the next step in the process, where Miss May and Gentilly gets a bad bill. And rather than waiting weeks or months, that hopefully within one, two phone calls and maybe a follow-up email, we're done in days, and hopefully a week or 10 days, and not extending the process. So, listen, we're committed to it. We're putting our money behind it. We're putting our efforts behind it. And look, we want the accountability from the contractor too. I mean, one of the things we've baked in to all of this is obviously wanting to make sure that timelines are improved, that outcomes are improving, and that everything is working better, because in our minds, again, this is how I feel, it's politically easy to beat up on Sewage and Water Board all of the time and kind of make it a red meat issue. That doesn't solve the problem, though. The problem gets solved by making the incremental change we're all interested in until the smart meters are all online, and trying to restore the credibility and making sure that people see, feel, can touch those changes.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully we get to some resolution there for sure. Obviously, one of the other issues that you guys have been working on relative to power is Entergy and power outages. It seems as though throughout the metro area, actually throughout the state of Louisiana, we've been seeing power outages a little bit more frequently for a whole host of crazy reasons. Your thoughts?
Well, we're seeing more and more on that. Obviously, I've seen Jefferson Parish and Scott Walker and other of the council members there raising the prospect of what's going on. So this isn't just a New Orleans issue, as you point out. And look, I try and look at things when my anecdotal evidence gets high and my analytical information gets high, then objectively and subjectively, I know that I have an issue. And here, my residents are complaining too often about losing power. That's the anecdotal side. And then analytically, people in District A in certain parts are losing power 2.5 times or 3 times a month. That's too much. And as discussed before, it's not like we've had 7 hurricanes or tropical storms through the metro area. These have been on clear days, fair weather days, not in extraordinarily heated conditions. So what's going on? And look, I think the other piece I feel about this is I've never been of a, well, let's starve an entity and make them so skinny that they can't operate. Obviously, you need to have capital and money to be able to do things. But at the same time, we shouldn't be losing power 3-4 times a month and not have a plan about what we're doing to fix it. So, again, I see it's the same sort of situation with sewage and water board. I understand Rome isn't built in a day, but what are we doing incrementally to do the things that need to be done to restore confidence for our consumers?
Yeah, I mean, it's and some of these things are outside of everybody's control, though, right, relative to some of these power outages?
Yeah, look, I think obviously if you have an act of God, a tornado, a hurricane, sure, that's out of people's power. I think in many cases they've tried their level best, and I hate to say it, but you've had an animal do something to a transformer or to another piece of heavy equipment. That becomes a problem. You can't outlaw squirrels and birds. So what are we doing to minimize their impact on what's going on? In instances, I'm sure infrastructure is old. Things are hotter. One of the things I'm sure we're starting to hear is that last summer was one of the hottest ever on record and also very little rain. So the equipment is having problems at a higher rate. We also heard Energy say that in some of the instances in our district, some of the equipment that they got is faulty. Well, that's not Energy's fault per se, but it's about, okay, well, what are we doing to replace that equipment? So I think you're being very fair, which is what I want to be too. You can't control the weather. You can't control nature. And so knowing that you can't do those things, what are the things that are within your power that you can function forward on?
Joe, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about these code enforcement sweeps. There was an article the other day. I was in Gambit or NOLA.com. I was very critical of the article, you know, setting aside folks as enemies, you know, that the bucket beaters are not the enemy and this one's not the enemy and on and on. You know as well as I've been talking about this culture of noncompliance. I've been on radio 7 years, probably at least 5, if not 6 of the 7 years. And the moment in time that there starts to be a concerted effort to engage in code enforcement sweeps, which is not unique to the city of New Orleans. It's done in almost every city that's ever re-engineered themselves and taken the streets back. You know, that all of a sudden now, you know, we're viewing folks that are non-compliant as enemies, and they're talking about making mountains out of molehills. Are these really molehills, though?
Well, look, that was my quote, so I said that one. The answer to me is based on two things. One is I'm also very much a consistency person. And so when you see things being enforced inconsistently, as obviously I've had problems with on some of the city planning issues, it's frustrating to me. And so I do not like, if we are going to say that we are going to do something as a city, then fine, it has to be even-handed, predictable, and consistent. And mm-hmm. and secondly, I do worry a lot, Newell, and in my perspective, representing a district that tends to be more affluent, I hear more from people about issues in Lakeview or in Uptown. And that's great. I want to hear from my residents no matter where they are. But I also worry that sometimes people get like the short end of the stick when they don't have access and they have a reasonable complaint about how that enforcement is being done. I'll give you one quick example. There's a house in my district where apparently there are some code enforcement issues. One of the owners is the daughter, the children of the people who own the property, put a new roof on the house and is trying to actually partition the house for sale because they realize that there's these problems and that one of the siblings is the cause of one of the problems. Well, in that instance, to me, code enforcement needs to do two things. They have to be fair about the enforcement and can't say, well, you're going to go 6 years without doing anything. But at the same time, if the family is trying to sell the house and trying to do things and put it back into commerce, then are we working with them to make that happen? And so that's where I sometimes have frustration is I think when you do enforcement and look, you've done it a lot longer than I have, so you know better than I do. I think you just need to be careful in the sense that it needs to be even-handed and it needs to be people have a level playing field.
No doubt. I mean, I think all of that makes perfect sense. It still comes down to a prioritization. I mean, it's not unlike we haven't realized and recognized the challenges in the French Quarter for a long, long time. You know, and I think people are weary of what's going on there. I mean, it's throughout the city. I mean, when you think about having 20-some-odd thousand blighted homes in a city since Katrina, right? This is a long time, and yet we've yet to develop a systematic approach and remediation to the problem. I mean, and what it highlights is it really reveals the underbelly of the unwillingness of city administration, not the council, but city administration, to not really take this seriously because it would impact property owners. But these are property owners that, for whatever reason, are not able to deal with their property. That's fine. We understand those challenges, but it doesn't mean that we should allow these people to create an environment and a culture of reducing the value of everyone's properties around it. And I mean, you hear these stories day after day after day after day. I mean, that's not a molehill. I mean, that's a huge problem, and I think the same thing exists in the French Quarter. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. I interrupted you. No, I listen, on the blight stuff in particular, I so much agree with you that it'd be really good for the city, and I think they're trying to get there under Director Davis, to have a blight strategy and what's going on and based on age and what is happening. And I say all the time, and again, you can stop me if I'm wrong, you want to talk about a public health, public safety strategy? Go knock down blighted houses in neighborhoods.
Sure.
I mean, they are right? They're places where people do drugs. They're places where you have prostitution. It is
go
bad
ask
activity.
Detroit. Go ask Detroit what they did.
and
it's not
and
rocket listen, science.
And so, it isn't. And so, I've said all along, part of the reason the council granted $20 million to code enforcement for blight abatement is because, to me, that's part of the public health, public safety plan. We have to go knock those houses down. Now, Newell, this is always where I sometimes will go back and forth with city agencies is there's also a difference between slumlord who's known how to evade the rules and knows the process and has kicked the can down the road versus the one person who has one little thing and you're elevating that one little thing to the top of the list. So I guess on all these things, what I like is, all right, who are the people who are the pick a number, top 10, top 25 worst violators? and who are known to be bad actors and have done everything they can to delay, deny, defer, and make examples out of them. And then let's work our way down the list. And honestly, my hope also is, I think part of this is what you're saying too, when you show landlords, scofflaws, others, that there's consequences, then hopefully the people who are further down go, oh, the city's coming. Like, we can't mess around anymore. And then it regulates itself rather than the city having to be regulator in chief of thousands of things.
Absolutely, for sure. Thank you so much, Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member, District A. Always appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great week.
Thank you, Neil. Take care.
All righty. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Stay with us. Folks, when we return after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. We'll talk about the Jackson Hole meeting and the remarks by Chairman Powell. All of the details on the new rules for real estate commissions, the Taylor Swift Facebook ticket fraud, the collapse of FinTech Synapse leaves millions of investor dollars stranded. We'll also talk about taxes and where that's headed and what's being talked about. We'll be right back with Guy Williams.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
For the past three seasons of Gone South, we've covered one story per season. Now, Gone South is back for a fourth season. But this time, we're doing things a little differently. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.